If you are still doing any holiday shopping, I know who you are, you procrastinators out there. Consider a Fretboard Journal gift subscription. You can go to fretboardjournal.com, click on the subscribe button, place your subscription, and when you're checking out, use the coupon code PODCAST, and I will take $5 off of your order just for listening to the Fretboard Journal podcast. Hey gang, welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I am Jason Berlindi, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal magazine. I hope everyone out there is having a great and happy and sane holiday season. I am guessing that for a lot of you, this is going to be the last Fretboard Journal podcast you hear in 2018. And I wanted to go out with a bang. So this is, without a doubt, one of my favorite chats of 2018. We snuck it in just under the wire. About a week ago, I met Kenneth Pattingale of the Milk Carton Kids here in Seattle. He was in town for about all of 24 hours. We hunkered down in his motel room and we chatted about all sorts of amazing things, but mostly, of course, about guitars. We chatted about his Martin O15, of course, that you've seen him play in the Milk Carton Kids umpteen times. But we also chatted a ton about this incredible new project that he just unveiled, the Martin Guitars Kenneth Pattingale Special. As you're about to hear, this is an instrument that was a collaboration between Kenneth, George Groen, and Martin Guitars. This is not a typical Martin signature model instrument. It is something else entirely. I don't really know how to describe it, but it's a pretty amazing story. Kenneth wanted to make an affordable American-made guitar that was built all for tone and volume and not for bling. He picked a dollar amount, $2,100, as you'll hear, and they kind of reverse engineered it from there and just saw what exactly they could cram into this box to make it as great a guitar as possible. And Kenneth is a total stickler for the important things. And I got to say, when I go down to Nashville, I cannot wait to try one out. Kenneth didn't bring one to Seattle, but I am so intrigued by this guitar. I'm going to be making a trek to Groen's very soon to try one out. And when I go down there, I'm going to be talking to Kenneth some more because it sounds like he has an incredible guitar collection at this point, and I would love to see it and photograph it and share it with you guys. Before we get to our conversation, as always, I want to thank our three big sponsors for the Fretboard Journal podcast. They are Lee Valley Tools, Retrofret Vintage Guitars, and Loudon Guitars. I cannot thank them enough for supporting us in 2008. And as we embark upon 2019, we're talking to some new sponsors. So if by some odd chance someone out there works for a guitar company that might be a great fit to partner with the Fretboard Journal podcast, just reach out to me, jason@fretboardjournal.com. And let's talk shop. Let's see if there's a good fit there. I want to thank everybody who listened to our last few podcasts and decided to join our new Fretboard Journal Insider program. If you don't know about that, you can read about it at fretboardjournal.com/insider. It is a very cool way to connect with us and also to help us grow. We have a ton of things we want to pull off next year here at the Fretboard Journal. More issues of the print magazine, a new podcast studio, maybe a new place where we film our videos. We've got a whole laundry list of things we want to do, and we can't do that without your support. So go on over to fretboardjournal.com/insider. And while you're over at our website, you should probably check out one of the most recent videos we posted. Brian Sutton playing You Are My Sunshine. You are wondering why Brian Sutton is playing a tune that everybody knows, and that is because earlier this year, Brian pitched us the crazy idea that we should ask everyone who comes through our office to play the exact same tune, and at the end of the year, see how everybody's interpretations varied. And we did that, and we have now, I don't know, 15 videos of amazing artists playing their take of You Are My Sunshine. Some are depressing, some are upbeat, some are traditional, some are totally crazy. We're going to be sharing those with you guys for the next few months. We're going to let those trickle out. But as we embark upon spring 2019, I guess. But the first one, which is Brian Sutton himself, is up on fretboardjournal.com, and you should check that out. All right, our first sponsor for today's podcast is our friends over at Retrofret Vintage Guitars. In my estimation, they have one of the great vintage guitar stores in the world. And they also, of course, have an incredible repair and restoration department. Right now, in stock, they have the Holy Grail of ukuleles and 1924 Martin 5K. They also have a 36 Gibson HG00 that looked incredible, and perhaps coolest of all, a Larson Brothers Euphonon Dreadnought from 1938. How often do you see those? If your name is Don, you need to buy this guitar. It actually has Don on the headstock. But even if your name isn't Don, you should check out that guitar because it is one of the amazing, amazing vintage acoustics ever built. One of the most amazing ones. Go to retrofret.com, see what they have, see their showroom in New York City if you are anywhere near there, and by all means, tell them the Fretboard Journal sent you. Our second sponsor is our friends over at Lee Valley Tools. For years, woodworkers have relied on Lee Valley for high-end tools, and now guess what? They're servicing the needs of luthiers around the world, too. They have pretty much everything you would need to start or finish your next guitar project. I just finished a parts caster. And a friend of mine who is a well-known luthier helped me out, taught me how to solder just on Monday, in fact. And guess what I found myself using to remount some tuner bushings? Some tools from Lee Valley. They're everywhere. They are so great. Go to leevalley.com and see their full offerings. Last but not least, this podcast is sponsored by Loudon Guitars. George Loudon and his team craft some of the best sounding and most beautiful acoustic guitars I've ever seen. And their new Winter 2018 limited edition collection does not disappoint. It took them 10 years to track down Tiger Myrtle that they could use for the back and sides of these 25 guitars. And I have to say, it looks like it was worth the wait. These guitars look incredible. Go to loudonguitars.com to read more about them. You can read about the new Loudon electric model of guitar and a lot more. Okay, without further ado, here is my talk with Kenneth. If anyone listens to this and wonders what the heck is the secret ingredient that he alludes to on his new guitar, I'm not going to tell you, but I will just say he told me after the microphone was off, and it's not a shortcut. It was nothing cheap. It was not laminated anything or anything like that. Just a cool quirk that ended up resulting in an even better guitar than he previously envisioned. So I'll leave it at that, and I just wanted to let everybody know, because I know where your minds go. Your minds go to shortcuts and cheats and laminated backs and sides and stuff. None of that is what happened. So I'll leave it there. Here is our chat with Kenneth from the Milk Carton Kids. Thank you guys so much for tuning in, and Happy New Year.
It's not like I conned them into it, but like there's no way that Martin makes a custom signature edition like the way they did with me. There's no way that that's how like the John Mayer deal went down or the Ed Sheeran deal went down, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I was going to ask you because, I mean, I think it was at Wintergrass years ago, like 4 or 5 years ago. I'm horrible with time.
Yeah.
But like and Critter and Julian went to Din Tai Fung and I was at the other up in the table and you were already talking about like what it would look like, what it would be. And I mean, even since that time, I mean, I know there's been a fair amount of, a couple key people at Martin have left.
Totally.
One retired, one's moved on. Like, yeah, I mean, this has been a long mission.
It's a really long mission. And when I say con job, I don't mean to like be demurring in my, I guess the fact that I deserve it or the fact, like whatever. This was in the beginning. There was an idea from Martin to make a signature guitar, which, like, if you went back and found a 12-year-old me in Eagle Rock, California, and told me that was happening, you know, you'd have to pinch him a whole lot. And so that still is, like, not only a great honor, but the seed of the whole thing.
Yeah.
But for that to actually then become a thing that I can sell to somebody, that five-year journey is bonkers.
Yeah.
Because it really started with that. It started with Fred Green and Imani Duncan. Imani's no longer at Martin. Fred's there in a different position. But it really was like, you know, they're a pretty incredible company insofar as how they first connect to their community and how they foster their community. I mean, these are guitar nuts, like,
yeah,
as they always have been. And of course, when we all think about the golden era, Martin Guitars, it means that they have a history that sort of honors that guitar nutdom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and because I don't think anybody, that's sort of a unique claim to have, is these people that are so obsessed with the nuance of what an instrument is for their lineage then to lead back to the thing that we all actually look to as sort of a gold standard,
yeah,
is pretty unique. And they take it quite seriously. They're fanatics over there. And so when that comes up, my worry was, as it often is in this career, is that Joey and I are niche enough to not command leverage, but also like visible enough to bring about some of these relationships and some of these ideas.
Sure.
And so when they started talking about a signature guitar, you know, there's a side of me that says, yeah, of course I deserve that. That's cool. And another side that says, that's completely impossible. This is weird.
Yeah.
And so that's what the last 5 years have been navigating, because basically the first order of business when I went back to them and said, here, this is the guitar, this is the design, which basically, I always wanted it to be to pay homage to the 015 I play from the 50s.
Yeah.
There's a few very specific qualities and characteristics that I think should be copied and are absent from modern guitars, specifically good craftsmanship that doesn't come with a bunch of bells and whistles that drive the price up.
Yeah.
Like, you should have an option where if you want to invest money in just having a well-built guitar without all the other crap, that should be there, which is exactly what the 015 was in the mid-50s. And so I brought that idea to them. Fred was ecstatic about it, loved it, and then sort of the first sobering conversation that was had immediately following the design thing, he goes, well, Kenneth, you guys aren't famous enough for Martin to run this up on the line and put it in every guitar center on earth.
Mm-hmm.
That's like, an initial $2 million investment or something.
Got it.
Which I'm sure Martin actually has the money for, but it would be silly to waste that on a band that, you know, whatever, of our size.
Sure.
If you're talking about Seth Avett, cool.
Yeah.
You know, there's kids that walk into Guitar Center every day probably looking at that. Nobody's going to recognize my name. Seldom few are.
Yeah.
He goes, but I've got a plan of how we can actually get this done, which is we'll partner with George Gruen in Nashville. And if we get him involved, we can do this in a way where it's the same endorsement from us. It's the same implication. It just means that we'll run it through a smaller order through the custom shop and have George involved as an exclusive retailer. And that'll be like a creative way we can solve the problem of doing the run but not making the massive capital investment on Martin's side. And I said, great. There's no way George Gruen knows my band or likes my band. Like, how do you think that's possibly going to work? And Fred says, well, George, if we call George and ask him, he'll say yes.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, if that's cool.
Yeah.
And so I get a call back from Fred who says, we called up George and we said exactly what we're talking about. We have an artist that we want to endorse, but we want to do a smaller limited run, blah, blah, blah. Will you be involved? And George said, yes, absolutely. Sight unseen.
Okay.
There's also George, who's a pretty incredible man, a strange man, incredible man. He is, I mean, at this point, I think it's undisputed, like the world's foremost guitar seller. I mean, both insofar as reputation and history and just like good old-fashioned horse trading. Like,
yeah.
Like, nobody can sell a guitar better than George Gruen.
Yeah.
And I've been in there myself. The countless hours I've spent in there working on this guitar, he tries to sell me other guitars. And it's really hard to resist because he just has a personality that like works you over in a certain way.
Try this.
Yeah, try this. I think it would be perfect for you.
Yes.
So I go down to Nashville to meet George the first time after he, sight unseen, agreed to collaborate with and fund a guitar for me.
He hadn't heard of you guys.
No, and okay. I just couldn't believe it. I go, what am I walking into? This is crazy. And so I show up, and sure enough, it was that. It's, you know, basically they wanted to do a limited run in the beginning, and George got a call from Martin, said, you know, essentially saying, we want you to order 50 guitars mm-hmm. and sell them, and George can do that in his sleep. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't care what's associated with it. And so I walk in and I show him the idea and we talk about it. We get to know each other. I talk about my band a little bit. And George, who is an exceedingly unique guy, you know, his first reaction after my whole pitch is he goes, well, Kenneth, I don't like small-bodied guitars. And I think, oh, fuck, this is going to be a nightmare.
Deal breaker.
Yeah. And so sure enough, for a year and a half after that, I would go down to Gruen's and we'd spend 4 hours walking around the second floor of his shop arguing, you know, and I'm like scared of snakes and he's got snakes everywhere he's got the cats everywhere and cats bother me. And so it's just this nightmare year and a half of us not coming together on what an interesting design would be because he wasn't necessarily sold on my outlook or my values.
Yeah.
And so I thought that I had to take a different approach rhetorically with him. And so I managed. George also famously like doesn't listen to music. He won't listen to the radio. He doesn't like the sound of CDs. He spends a lot of time backstage at the Opry and he'll bring guitars from the shop. Essentially it's a mixture, I think, of him liking to be a part of the scene, and also like he takes guitars and sells them to Vince Gill and whoever, you know, he takes special guitars back there. And so I managed to get his assistant at the time to get him out of the house, which was sort of unheard of, to a milk carton kids show.
Okay.
And so
where was it?
It was at the Polk Theater at TPAC in Nashville.
Okay.
Beautiful 1400 seat, you know, performing arts space. A sort of unusual venue for Nashville. If you say it, if you say there's a concert there in town, everybody goes, where? Yeah. What? But then, you know, 1,000 people showed up, and it was a great show. We had I think that was the tour we had the Goodbye Girls open with Molly Tuttle as a centerpiece in that. And that was in, gosh, I think that was 2015. Yeah, this was 2015. Years this is the part this. Of the story. Yeah, years you, into it, and
you still
and
haven't
years
even
ago.
Made a single prototype or anything.
No, well, actually, I should rewind. I haven't thought through this story clearly enough, because we did make a prototype before that. Again, Martin also is famously generous with this stuff. So the first, when the idea came up before George was on board, they did make me two guitars based on the idea, just to hear what they sounded like. And that original idea was essentially the 015 and from the 50s, but with the top and back sanded down a little bit further than what the Martin Council office is comfortable with. You know, they have the famous workman's guarantee on those guitars that, you know, any Martin guitar you bought, if you're the original owner, if anything's wrong with it, you send it back to Nazareth and they'll fix it.
Yeah.
And so they don't want to be sending guitars out that are going to be coming back.
Yeah.
But I thought, I still think that the new, I guess it's more of a function of the lacquers and the different finishes than it is necessarily the thickness of spruce or mahogany. But newer Martin guitars, even if you take into account the amount of like aging and drying out of the wood will happen, I think they're built a little more robustly now than they were back then. It might be a function of building methods also, and maybe some of the stuff that happened by hand back then that happens by machine now, maybe that makes a difference.
Yeah.
But one of the working theories was to sand the top and the back down a little further than they were comfortable.
Okay.
And so they made me two guitars that were quite beautiful, and this was before I met George even. But the first one, you know, is kind of a function of like giving a kid the keys to a candy store or something.
Okay.
Because I went in the first time and Fred said, "Anything you want." I said, "Really, anything I want?" And so what I ended up making is this guitar that I still have, and I took out on a tour once, and it sounds amazing. But I made this guitar that then, when it was all said and done, Fred told me I made a guitar that holds two distinctions in the history of Martin.
Okay.
And one of them is that it's the most expensive single-O model like ever made in Martin guitar history.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And then additionally, perhaps even more impressive, it's the most expensive, it's the most actual expensive guitar in Martin history ever made that doesn't have any like perloid involved. Because what it was everything was custom, and it was like a pyramid bridge, and it was hide glue and bar frets.
Got it.
And I had to put these friction pegs on that look more like violin pegs and banjo tuners than the guitar tuners. And nothing on the rosewood fretboard, not a single dot or marking, anything. And the idea, again, it wasn't really an idea other than just like me pick out my favorite things and see what the guitar sounds like. But in making literally every decision custom and endeavoring to build this guitar that when you look at it, it's literally just beautiful wood. The tuning pegs are tucked behind the headstock, and there's not a single graphic or marking on the front, and it's mahogany that then has this custom stain that's inspired by 32017 that I own.
Okay.
That's shade top, back, and sides, like a very rare finish from Martin. It's this like crazy guitar that, because they did everything custom, it like what it, from workman's wages to materials, it just like it ended up being like a $25,000 single O Martin. And so after it was all said and done, Fred came to me and said, "You have two records now at Martin, and these are them." I go, "Oh shit!" But obviously, that was not the right guitar for this project, and it wasn't even the spirit of what I wanted to do. What I wanted to do was find a way to inspire them to put some muscle into the craftsmanship and get rid of the stuff that otherwise is frivolous. And so I did have some prototypes at this point, but they weren't necessarily germane to what Fred and I were going to do and what we actually have done now. But so I finally get him to this concert.
Yep.
And we play the concert, and afterwards, his assistant at the time, Sarah, she's sort of like, George is there, and I see Sarah first, and she goes, "He loved it." She goes, "Just full disclosure, he like fell asleep for 30 minutes of it, but like that's just because he's old and tired. Like don't take anything by that." Because then what happened is George, who I'd been not arguing with for a year and a half, but locked in a disagreement, a fundamental disagreement about preference and about taste and style, he spoke to me for a half an hour after that show about how important he thought the work Joey and I were doing for acoustic guitars.
Yeah.
Because he sat in a beautiful performing arts center where we played our two vintage guitars in front of that one ear trumpet lab mic.
Yep.
And it's the best sounding concert he's ever been to. And it sounds like, I mean, basically our concerts when we play as a duo in front of that microphone really are in some ways like a love letter to the acoustic guitar.
Yeah.
That's what it is. There's no, we have made so many accommodations in our lives and in our performances to maintain what that sound is.
Yeah.
And it's a really hard area to protect. You know, the demands of live music and of bands and of sound, one of the first things to go is like the veracity of the acoustic guitar sound.
Sure.
Even to the point on our tour with the band now, both Joey and I are plugging in, and we have a, you know, it's a different thing. Thank God we have a front of house engineer that makes them sound like something.
Yeah.
But those duo shows really are special insofar as how they translate the sound of an acoustic guitar. And that turned George's mind around entirely. And I knew I had one rhetorical play, and it was a big gamble, but I took it. Was he came, I converted him to be a fan of ours, and then I decided to basically turn my phone off for a year and a half. And I didn't call him. We were working a lot. I spent a lot more time in New York that year than in Nashville. But basically 18 months later, I walked back into George's shop with the same guitar idea I had 3 years earlier and said, "George, I've really figured out my guitar design idea. This is the one I want." And he said, "Great, let's do it." And it was like, to me, the turning point was once I had him in the mindset of actually knowing what we did.
Yeah.
I figured that a little bit of time and a little bit of distance just in his mind without thinking about it would change his opinion of me and his association with me, that if I came in with an idea that he didn't necessarily agree with, that now he had the information that would allow him to trust, I guess, trust me.
Yeah.
And so also in that time, I had Martin build another guitar, which is basically exactly a copy of my 015, so that I think we had done an Australian tour in the interim, and in Australia, they famously don't let you bring your guitar on the airplane. You always have to check it underneath.
Oh, sucks.
Yeah, it's terrible. And for a vintage guitar collector, it's the most anxiety fueling experience. And so we went and did an Australian tour, and I called Martin up. I said, "Can you just make one that's going to sound exactly like this?" Which means we don't have to do all the crazy crap we did on that last guitar, but we do need to put just two coats of finish on it, not the 17 coats of lacquer and sanding and, you know, all the different things. And that one we also sanded down the top and backs a little bit. And so they made a guitar that also I was very happy with. We went down to Australia and I played it, and like, it actually intonates well, unlike my guitar from the 50s. The action's much better. It's much easier to play. And there's a last, you know, a few little details on the end that aren't quite exactly the same sound, but it fooled everybody, including Joey, you know, basically in what we were doing. And so when I walked back into George and said, "Here's the idea," I also had a guitar in hand.
Got it.
That he could play and he could hear in the room. George also, for all of his tastes and all of his convictions, one of them, which it took me a little while to wrap my head around, was he is a staunch supporter and fan of modern Martin guitars.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you got him talking about it, he would say that they're building them better than ever, that they sound as good as ever. He's a real, like, he really truly believes in it. And this is a guy that essentially, like started the vintage guitar market.
Yeah.
And valued it.
You know? And has every reason to be jaded about every trend or new product.
Totally.
Yeah.
But he's a real supporter, and it took me a while to come around on that idea, and he did ultimately convince me, and it was from a lot of hours spent in that shop, and also again with a number of these prototypes that Martin made, the way that they get worn in and the way that the strings age and the way that, you know, just the physical act of playing a guitar over time, both it adapts to you and you adapt to it.
Yeah.
I found myself over this whole experience for the first time, like, actually enjoying playing a newer guitar, and not, you know, it's something that I would take to sessions and play and not be caught up on how it sounds different from the guitars I own that are vintage. You know, no longer was there a prejudice that I held towards the differentness. And to George's credit, he's a great supporter and fan of that. And so we had this guitar that now we both liked. He was behind, and it's a simple enough idea where we can continue to chip away at, like, to me, the the thing I always wanted to do specifically with this guitar was basically me at age 20 when I walked into a guitar store with $2,000 for the first time wanting to buy a serious guitar.
Yeah.
You walk in there and you, at the end of the day, you're forced to go look in the vintage section and on the lower end, because for $2,000 you can't buy a new guitar.
Yeah.
That's worth the money.
Sure.
And you can in the vintage section, but for $2,000 you're going to find one that's got something wrong with it.
Yeah.
And so what my main goal was, somebody who was going to spend their first $2,000 on a real guitar, they could walk in, and after going through that whole process, the person, if the salesperson is knowledgeable enough, they can go, actually, there is one guitar you should look at.
Yeah.
That's not going to give your hand trouble, is not going to have intonation problems. It sounds like an older guitar for this, and this reason, but it's a newer guitar. That was my goal always. And so the quality of the sound obviously was paramount, but also keeping the costs minimal was the trickiest challenge. And so George was on board with me there on all fronts. And so then began the last sort of year and a half saga of how do we actually get a guitar on sale for $2,100.
Yeah.
That is made in the U.S., is made of real wood, has the Martin logo on. I mean, like, literally every single quality is an immediate kind of upcharge and upsell that seemed completely unfathomable.
Yeah.
And the political saga that ensued over the last 18 months is insane madness that, again, right now I can't believe that we actually got the guitar on sale and that it came to be, because the amount of times George and Martin were deadlocked on pricing and on, you know, different components, and me and Martin on the same front, there were probably 6 or 7 times where I thought the whole project was dead in the water. And I would spend the rest of my life fielding questions about, remember that time you talked about your signature model? What happened there? And thinking of the various lies I would have to come up with to talk about its demise. But strangely, in the end, literally everybody came to the table. And it was the kind of crazy stuff where basically what we made, I had to move off of some of my design elements, which is fine, to accommodate for some of the things that Martin could actually do. One of George's major contributions, or just his insistence for maintaining his position, was that he insisted that these be made on the regular factory line and not through the custom shop.
Okay. Because
the minute a guitar gets bumped to the custom shop, enough stuff happens to it that the guitar is going to jump up, you know, $1,500 in costs. And so he was always trying to push for it to happen on the factory line, whereas Martin has some policies in place where, you can't change the top on an 018 to this and run it on the factory line because of, you know, the way that they envision their company and the way that they create their products. And so there was all these, different creative problems that had to be solved where, in the end, one of the initial bits of feedback or confusion that some of my fans as a guitar player have found is that this guitar has a spruce top and not a mahogany top.
Yeah.
Which those 015s, literally their signature comes from the mahogany top. And that was one of the ones up until, I guess about a year ago or 10 months ago, where it finally reached the point where it's like, oh, this guitar is not going to be achieved with a mahogany top. Now is the time, can I conceive of this being something with a spruce top and not a mahogany top? And basically, if the answer was no, it means the project's dead.
Yeah.
And so the answer has to be yes. And so what happened was I started, in my own private time, playing new Martin guitars with a spruce top.
Yeah.
And figuring out that absolutely I can get behind it and play it and find expressiveness in the sound and find pleasure in the sound. And there was a conversation where that was really hard for me to get over, to figure out if the only reason somebody's buying this guitar is because they're interested in not necessarily sounding like me, but because I inspired them to pick up a certain guitar or achieve a certain sound. Am I selling them a bill of goods if it's not the thing that specifically I'm known for or specifically they've heard? And it, like, it actually, this sounds so dramatic, but it actually took a number of sleepless nights in convincing myself that actually the people interested in what I do, they're interested in what comes out of my brain and what what my musical intuition is and what my musical contribution is, and that if somebody is actually compelled to buy a guitar based on my endorsement or based on my influence or my aspiration, actually the mahogany top is irrelevant.
Yeah.
And also sort of in order to prove that, and it was one of the things we talked to George about before he finally wrote the checks and green lit it, is because I sort of struggled with that question, and he posed a very simple way to figure out like what was true. And I said, well, like, will you play this guitar on stage in your band?
Mm-hmm.
And I'd been playing the guitar for a year, and so without even thinking about it, obviously the answer is yes. It's a wonderful guitar. It sounds great. The added sort of texture and high-end overtone off that spruce top is something that in some ways was always lacking and missing off the 015 and the mahogany. And so, yeah, I'd be happy to play it. And sort of right in that answer, there was sort of cleared my conscience of anything funny there. But again, that thing, the spruce thing, was interesting because it was another, that was one of the compromises, that essentially this guitar is a variation on an 018. Although now when you look at it, enough has changed that it's not an 018. You can't really call it an 018 because there's certain things that an 018 has that this guitar just doesn't have, and so it's not a variation on it. But it's closer to an 018 than it is to an 015. And so when we're running it on the factory line and not through the custom shop, we're modifying an 018, not an 015. And so based on some company policies, we can't modify an 018 and put a mahogany top on it. That's why it would be impossible. If we were going to do the mahogany guitar, it would have been $3,500 minimum to the customer, which completely invalidates the point of the thing. And so all things said and done, what we achieved is exactly what I set out for it to be and is actually a miracle, which is for $2,150, you can buy a Martin guitar that's made on American soil that has not only Adirondack spruce top, but a torrified Adirondack spruce top, genuine mahogany sides with a rosewood fingerboard. You can buy that guitar with X bracing and a simple dovetail joint instead of a compound dovetail joint. But you can buy that guitar, which is remarkable, for $2,150. There's actually not... In the end, George and I were both surprised that Martin actually even let us sell it, because there's not a single guitar in their line that's made in Nazareth that has real wood that is of that veracity and of that tone, even in that price range.
Yeah.
And it was, so it was like, it was pretty crazy what we, like the caper that we pulled off in the end, because to me, again, the only thing we were going for was keep the cost down and make them build it correctly.
Yeah.
And it's exactly what we did. It's crazy, because they haven't built a guitar like that since the 50s, where it's like, you know, the there's different pejoratives thrown around for what it is, but like, they sometimes the 015's called a student model.
Yeah.
It's not a student model. It is a student model because students could afford it, but it's in the construction, in the materials, it's not a lesser model. It's the same as the D28, just with less stuff on it. And a different pattern of the body. But that thing, for whatever reason, I would assume that just sort of business climate and selling points in the guitar industry. That stuff started going out of fashion after the 50s. There, you know, there was no longer a premium placed on craftsmanship and longevity and just the, you know, the fundamental characteristics of a good guitar. More expensive guitars were the ones that had more adornment and higher aesthetic appeal. And so it was, it seemed like an impossible goal to achieve that somehow, like, somehow we managed to pull off.
You reverse engineered it around a price, which is kind of crazy.
Which is crazy.
Yeah.
It's totally bonkers.
What did you do aside from literally coloring it? Like, was there anything they did differently to make the spruce top sound more like a mahogany top? Was there some mojo going on there? Or?
No, it's all... It's an incredible sounding guitar that's just from good design and good craftsmanship. Mm-hmm. And that thing... So the coloring is literally an aesthetic choice.
Yeah.
I like a darker guitar. There's one component... I've been thinking the last week about how I can say it on the podcast. There's one thing that I can't talk about.
It's got MIDI.
Yeah, it's got MIDI.
Okay, cool.
No, there's one trick that sort of results in a real lucky turn of events to bring the guitar in, like, at the cost the way that it is, and it all being real and it being specifically with the torrified top, that I just got lucky on it and it's cool, and I will tell you off the air about it because you'll be interested.
Listeners, try me with alcohol the next time you see me.
There you go.
Yeah.
But outside of that thing, we let the guitar speak for itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a torrified Adirondack spruce top that sounds as good as it's going to sound because they did it the right way and they built it the right way. And they painted it dark because I like it dark.
Yeah.
And that's kind of it. But which is also really cool because Martin had never stained a torrified spruce top that way out of the factory. And it's like when you look at this guitar up in close, it's a really interesting looking guitar. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
The whole thing's kind of unlikely and strange and like it was not only like a personal crusade of mine for 5 years to make it happen, but also one that was entirely outside of me because it took George and specifically George and everything that comes with George for it to go down the way that it went down. And the same thing with Martin, specifically Fred Green and Chris Thomas over there, but Fred Green was rolling up his sleeves with me. The guitar wouldn't happen if he wasn't also like putting his thinking cap on and figuring out creative ways to actually get that guitar done.
Yeah.
It's pretty crazy.
It is crazy. I mean, the 018 is kind of still affordable. Like the original, the 50s ones are still affordable. I'm wondering what was it about that guitar that, obviously, you've made a career with that guitar, but like, was there stuff that was lacking? Were there inconsistencies? Was the intonation weird? Were there things where you're like, we can do better than this in 2018?
No, that guitar, strangely, and I own many of them. That guitar, for whatever reason, just the price never went up.
Yeah,
and it did. I've asked around since I started playing them. I managed myself to drive the price up on that model, which is annoying because I like to buy them.
It happens, yeah.
But like the one that I played for the first 7 years of Milk Carton Kids, I bought that for $1,100 off of eBay.
Yeah.
And I bought it sight unseen from a little old lady in Arizona.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't sure if that was going to show up and need a neck reset or if it was unplayable or what the deal was. And to be honest, there was a lot that's wrong with it that it didn't work itself out over the years. It all worked out. I mean, basically, there's a number of stories that very legitimately tie into that guitar. The first one being, like the handkerchief that I wrap around the neck
yeah.
is a function of that guitar showed up and it needed work and I didn't have the money to get it worked on
yeah.
nor like when I took it to my guy Norik Renzen in LA, he didn't really know what to do with it.
Yeah.
He was afraid of doing a full neck reset on it because he thought it would change the tonal characteristics of the guitar. And he didn't know how much it would actually help what was going on. But basically, like, that guitar, when Joey and I started playing in certain keys and I capoed above the fourth fret, everything started buzzing.
Yeah.
And I carry around a handkerchief. And so I tied that around it to make the buzzing go away. And then the thing sort of stuck. But that was a function of that guitar needing some work.
Mm-hmm.
And over the course of the first 3 years of our band, whatever was happening physically, maybe it's because I was taking it to different climates all over the world. More likely, it's probably because I was playing it every night. And
yeah.
the guitar, again, it like adapts to you as much as you adapt to it. After about 3 years, it doesn't need the handkerchief anymore. Like, it worked out its fret buzz.
Wow.
At the same time, that guitar, like, once you capo above five, like, it's really hard to play. Like,
mm-hmm.
we took Julian Lage out on tour with us in 2015, and he refused to play my guitar because it hurt his hands.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I've had some, like, hand and physical problems over the last few years where probably if I took that guitar and got it worked on at the beginning, maybe I wouldn't be dealing with, you know, some of what I'm dealing with. So the point being, anyway, with specifically with that guitar was it probably could have used some work, but what guitar from the 50s
yeah.
couldn't use some work? And again, it's a bit of a problem, but I have six or seven of them now.
Mm-hmm.
And each one has its own set of issues.
Okay.
That's, again, just like any other guitar from that era. I don't think it's about that model specifically.
Yeah.
But so that model, like I said, it's annoying. I think once Joey and I put it on the TV a few times and once people started coming to our concerts, then all of a sudden that guitar was selling for $3,500. And, you know, I've asked Mark Stutman outright about it, and I've asked Retrofret, and I've asked, you know, other guitar shops, you know, how can you be selling that 1952 015 for $3,700? And their response always is, well, you're part of the problem.
yeah.
You know, because they are, it would be $3,700 is a little too much for that guitar.
Yeah.
But $2,500 isn't. I'd pay $2,500 for it.
Yeah.
But yeah, for some reason, those 015s, I think it's also just a perception thing. I mean, I'm sure that you battle with this on a daily basis. What gives these guitars their value? You know, is it because a bunch of people who now have money grew up
pretty
watching
much.
Bob Dylan's, you know, play a specific model, or, you know, what is the thing?
Yeah.
Why would there be a multiple $1,000 difference between an 018 and 015 from the same exact period? I don't know, but
yeah.
there is.
Yeah.
If you walk into a shop with a 55018, it's going to be $4,500.
Yeah.
So I don't know all of the factors that go into it. It seems like there are some that are tangible and fixed physically, and then there's some that are just,
yeah.
You know, I also don't know. Again, I'm sure you end up in these conversations much more than I do, but it's sort of strange to think about. I don't know if you've heard the theories that some people have about, right, these ultra wealthy guitar hoarder collectors. Like, what happens when they start dying and
yeah.
their collections flood the vintage market? Is it gonna bring everything back down with it a bit? I don't know. I also know that, like, when I first got into the game, as it were,
mm-hmm.
of buying guitars, I guess about 15 years ago now, just my experience between what you see as a sticker price on, like, a 1948 D18
yeah.
15 years ago than what you would now, it makes me want to go buy a bunch of 1957 D18s just because 10
Rising
years
tide,
from,
yeah,
10 years from now you think they're going to be worth that much more. But I don't know what it is. I also know that I've not ever bought a guitar in my life that I didn't want to play and wasn't inspired by on a musical level.
Yeah.
And I also have never sold a guitar before. And those two, with those two things being driving forces of what informs my collection,
yeah,
I feel like that's a pretty good guiding light. And if I try to look at it in financial terms or be shrewd about it in any way,
yeah,
I'm going to get into some deeper waters than I can swim in.
It's a different, yeah, it's a different thing. What, do all of these 015s you have sound good? You've never sold any of them?
No, I've never sold any of them. One of them sounds like shit.
Okay, but you won't get rid of it?
No. Uh-uh. Because it might get better. You never know. I was thinking, I'm also just as I don't know if it's as time goes on or if it's, I don't know what it is, but I didn't do it last week just because it got busy, but I decided really without much deliberation that I am going to get a neck reset on my main guitar.
Okay. Who's doing that?
Glazer will do it.
Cool.
In Nashville.
Yeah.
But it's something that if it came to mind 4 years ago, I would have had to deliberate for on a long time.
Yeah.
But this one, I thought about it, and at this point, I actually just don't care if it comes back and it sounds different. I just don't believe it could sound that different.
Yeah.
And to me, that guitar that I love so much and have so much history with, it's really hard to play, and it makes my body hurt physically.
Yeah.
And, but I don't think it's worth it to like resist change.
Wow.
Or resist inevitability to happen and make myself suffer. I think it's just going and get it done. And if it's a different guitar, then it's a different guitar. I have a number. I have to make a distinction, which is that I consider the 017 to be the exact same thing as the 015, which it was. Up until the late 40s. No, up through the late... Yeah, up until the war.
Mm-hmm.
Pre-1945, the 015 and the 017 were actually identical except for the way that they polished the finish.
Okay.
And so now, 80 years later, you couldn't tell because none of the finishes remained, mm-hmm. you know, like, intact. So all of them aged in one way or another, but physically they're the same guitar. They're put together the same way, yeah. And so I consider those the same. So like four of the guitars are 017s from the 30s.
Okay.
But they really all do. They all have their own identity, but they're all very clearly a part of the same family.
Yeah.
My favorite one, we'll have to just at some point when we get around to actually doing all of the guitars for the magazine and like listing them or whatever, like
yeah.
chronicling them. It'll be fun to get into like what all the connections are, but my favorite one is a 1932 017 that has this very rare shade top that also happens on the sides and on the back.
Oh wow!
The neck and the as far as I've been able to figure out with Dick Boak's help, and then also just actually now about 15 years of research.
Mm-hmm.
It was my Moby Dick guitar that I'd been looking for years. Only 300 of them were known to be made.
Hmm.
And there's a few other people interested in that guitar who were keeping an eye out before I was even, and then I've thrown my lot in with theirs. But as of now, there's 14 known okay. to have survived. And I've got like a stupid spreadsheet on my computer with the serial number of each one and like when it popped up on this site to be
yeah.
sold and this site, whatever. And I had set up a bunch of triggers online for anything close that would ever come up on a Craigslist or
wow.
eBay would send me an email.
It was your Moby Dick.
Yeah, yeah. Totally obsessed. And sure enough, I had set the right eBay algorithms because a thing popped up marked completely wrong, but the minute I saw the picture, I go, this guy's got it wrong. Mm-hmm. This is the guitar. And he had it marked as like a 0015 from the 40s, which is weird. I mean, he wasn't a guitar guy. He was a pawnbroker in Chicago that got this guitar off of like at a liquidation estate sale. And he didn't do any kind of diligence in putting it back up for retail. Shockingly insufficient work. Like all you'd have to do is like run the serial number and you can get the year right.
Yeah.
But he had everything wrong.
Phoning it in.
Yeah. But just from a few pictures online, I ID'd, I said, know what this is. And so I wrote him, this is how much I wanted the guitar, was I wrote him and just leveled with him. I said, hey, I've been looking for this guitar for 10 years. You've got it marked all wrong. Like, because he published the serial number on the eBay listing.
Okay.
I said, it's actually from either 1932 or 1933. It's this very rare model. This is its street value, which was a few thousand dollars more than his like buy it now price.
Wow.
Whatever. I wrote him, here's the deal. This is the whole thing. But also, like, this is one of my great passions. And the guy, it was a really nice thing. We ended up on a number of phone calls. We did the thing that, I mean, I'm sure they must know Reverb and eBay at this point must know that
Chicago.
But that everybody, like, once it's online and then people find a way to connect outside of it, like the listing goes away and they avoid paying the eBay thing or whatever. But so this guy was like willing to give it to me for a reasonable price if I sent him cash.
Yeah.
So, you know, whatever, for all the various implications. And
and you didn't want to buy it now just because you wanted to be.
Yeah, I don't know what my thing was.
All right.
Because also, I think I had to confirm, it was a lot of money, and I think I had to confirm that, like, I had to talk to the guy and make sure that, whatever, just get some semblance. I mean, even after I sent, like, wired money to his bank account with no assurances, my girlfriend at the time said, you know, like, probably just a box of this guy's shit's going to show, like, you're totally screwed and unprotected like here.
Yeah.
But he and I got on the phone and we shared a number of phone calls where I got the right sense of it. And sure enough, when the guitar showed up, it was the guitar I'd been looking for a decade. And it's like this incredibly preserved example of it. And it sounds incredible. It's like, I found it was one of the itches that I had to scratch that when I did, it was like, oh, that was worthwhile.
It was worth it.
Yeah, totally worth it.
Wow.
That's one of my favorite. There's like four guitars out of the, I can't remember the last number. I have it written down. It's somewhere in the 70s. I have about 70 vintage guitars.
You have 70 vintage guitars now?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that one is like top four. There's like four guitars. Like I said, we'll do a thing.
We'll do a thing.
And we'll put the four.
Are all these housed in the same general location?
Yeah. Okay. Yes and no.
Okay.
Most of them.
All right.
Most of them, though. There's a good number of them. There's like 30 or so that kind of aren't worth
talking about.
Yeah, talking about or keeping it. So those are in a storage spot elsewhere. But like the main ones, it's funny. It's like every time somebody new comes over to the house that I know is a guitar fan.
They just.
Yeah, then I start coming out of rooms with cases. And at the end of the night when they get into their Uber and leave, like it's bedtime and I really want to go to bed, but there's like, you know, there's 25 guitars and there's cases everywhere. And then they have to go back in and go home and whatever.
Yeah.
But that's one of the ones, that 017 from 32. And a few other good ones. And then also my weird prototype is a good addition to the collection. And then also over this whole process, there's a number. That would be an once I have the time, I'll do it. There's sort of like an interesting physical trail from my first prototype with them through the number of guitars that they've made me that ends here that's actually really cool.
How many guitars do you think there were there of iterations before they got to...
It's a good, like, there are actually seven guitars, but sort of variations. So there's maybe like four steps of if it was like, if it started here and we moved here.
All right.
But also I could throw the vintage one on the front of that for another.
Okay.
Another step.
Like the caveman. That gets there.
Totally.
Okay. What, I mean, you the prototype, you got to be the kid in the candy store and just pull out every single stop, much to Martin's dismay.
Yeah.
Did it all deliver? Was it really? It did.
It's a great guitar. I mean, the weirdest, dumbest thing that I did to it is that the two pieces of mahogany that make the top, I decided at the last minute to shift them by, I think it was like 17 degrees, so that when you wear the guitar...
Oh, God, really?
Yeah, at the angle that like one typically wears the guitar, it means that the grain shifted so that it's parallel to the ground.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's totally weird. And they had never done it before, and they wondered aloud, I wonder if this will make it sound different. Because it's usually they cut it in half like... perpendicular, no, parallel to the grain. Like,
well, there's straight their down. Their sides are probably all chalked out for
totally.
So you really,
yeah, we did, yeah. But it delivered. It's a great sounding guitar. I did. I took it on tour once for it was a 18 show tour in 2014. We did with Sarah Jarosz. It was us three, and at that time in her band was Nat Smith and Alex Hargraves. Uh-huh. And then our friend Sam Grisman playing bass. We went and did the six of us a string of shows where all six of us were on stage. And like a third of the show was Milk Carton Kid songs that they played on. And a third of it was Sarah's songs that mm-hmm. we also sang harmonies on. And the other third was like kind of American songbook sort of things that we did. But that tour, I took that guitar out on that tour and did 18 shows with it. And it held up. But also... I took it out a few weeks ago to show my friend from Australia. This artist, C.W. Stone King, was in Nashville, and he came by the house to look at the guitars, and I brought it out. I hadn't taken it out of the case probably in 2 years, and it sounded better, as good as ever. Mm-hmm. It's a cool one, and it looks, it's a wacky guitar. It looks insane.
Did you have to get, a compass out when you were wearing the guitar to figure out how many degrees?
I eyeballed it.
You eyeballed it?
This is somehow with my dumb precise ideas, I'm comfortable with just putting my finger in the air. That's that you'll just have to live with that cognitive dissonance. I do.
All right.
Yeah. It's a good one though.
You're doing a bunch of production work right now, right?
A ton. We just finished a Joe Pug album last night.
Okay. Congrats.
Thank you. And next year, God, there's a number of projects that will come out next year. A Joy Williams album I produced, Anthony DaCosta album,
nice.
A Darren Bradbury album. That'll come out on Anti next year. And there's somebody I'm forgetting, somebody who will be mad at me for forgetting
this. They won't listen to the Fort Journal podcast, let's be honest here. And you love it?
I love it. It's a real... I'll put it this way. When I went in yesterday and we got the band back together, as it were, because we did about 4 days in October with Joe, and I had Dennis Crouch playing bass and Phil Cronengold from my band playing keys.
Uh-huh.
And I refused to make a record without Matt Ross Spang engineering it. He comes up from Memphis to do that, and he and I work together as a team that's really helpful in me clarifying sort of my production instincts. He's like a great sounding board for that. And so that, he and I have been doing those records all year. And when we got back together for one day yesterday, they all showed up and gave me crap for, I had the surprise honor of getting a Grammy nomination for Joey and my record for the one we just put out.
Yeah.
But very confusingly, we didn't get nominated on a musical level. And so it got nominated for the best engineered album, non-classical, which means that if we win it, I get a Grammy because I mixed the record and Joey doesn't get one. Which is which is really tricky.
Yeah.
And Joey's cool with, But it's very conflicted because I'm very conflicted because I think obviously in some ways it's an award given to our album.
Yeah.
You know, it wouldn't be that if we didn't write those songs and perform them and whatever. But it is an engineering nomination, and we had the incredible Ryan Freeland, who set up all the microphones and engineered the session and did, you know, the majority of the work on that front, and Joe Henry was producing. But there was the interim step of actually mixing the record that I did do. I put, like, poured my blood, sweat, and tears into it and made it sound the way that it sounds. But that was also, like, a shared vision of me and Joey over the last 10 years. You know, so much of that informed it. But I was the one doing it, turning the knobs and making it what it was. But for all of those reasons, I've had a hard time sort of accepting that.
Yeah.
That, like, never mind if I won, just even being nominated, accepting that I'm getting praise for my prowess as an engineer and my vision as an engineer, that, you know, in my secret heart of hearts, I want to be able to accept and have pride about.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, I was the primary artist on the album, and there's a number of people who dedicate their entire lives to engineering in a way that makes me feel like kind of not worthy of the honor.
Yeah.
But I walked into the room yesterday and relentlessly for all day was made fun of for my Grammy nomination for engineering, which both in when I went home realized that everybody was treating it exactly the right way, giving me shit for it, and at the same time it was their way of saying that they thought I actually deserved it.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of like as an extension of that, the production stuff, it sort of lights up my brain in the same way. It both acknowledges and validates that I have a lot to contribute it on that front.
Yeah.
And I really enjoy doing it. You know, somebody like a talent like Joe Pug, you know, all of these things. Joey and I need it too. I need Joey in order to realize what my best self is. Joe Pug deserves the attention of somebody who has his back, making sure that he's putting on record the things that he wants to. And I take great pleasure and feel quite nimble in being able, while that process is going down, to be able to help him realize what's happening and to tweak things and kind of change the environment so that it pushes everybody in one direction or a different direction. It's like a really validating part of the actual work that, in the end, as it turns out, I'm pretty good at.
So. Yeah. Did you, the experience with Joe Henry and the full band album, I mean, it sounds fantastic. Did you glean any, was there anything you learned on the production front from just watching Joe produce you guys?
I think that always, specifically with Joe, as his style of sort of lead by example, if I had to point to one thing I learned, I wouldn't really be able to pull it out of the air.
Yeah.
But if Joe didn't produce specifically that album, and also if I hadn't been around Joe for the last 10 years, I'm going to venture the guess that I would do everything differently than the way that I do it now.
Yeah.
And it's not like he ever sat me down and said, do this, 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 and this.
No.
But I think just being around it and being swimming in the same stream and seeing how many accomplishments are a result of just how parameters are set and style and how you carry yourself and how you talk about ideas and how you commit to ideas, that sort of thing, like, immediately integrates to your life vision and kind of goes into your blood in a way that I wouldn't be able to separate out now. So the answer is absolutely yes.
Yeah.
Of course, there's an impact. I wouldn't be able to tell you exactly the thing.
He sets a good example. He's a calming, welcoming presence, at least in my brief encounters with him. And
absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, and also if there's any secret to Joe Henry and a lot of the other people specifically around me that you can look to as far as advice, it's their commitment actually to the final, seeing the final vision realized.
Yeah.
And using that as a bellwether to make your decisions like in a very crude way. If something serves the final vision, then it's a yes. If it doesn't, it's completely unnecessary.
We all need to think that way.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, and that like, but that equally informs who you choose as a bass player, as it informs where you order lunch from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or who's paying for lunch, or what the vibe is. You know, like if it's something you can see as a part of the story that gets you to the thing that you stated in the beginning, great. If not, it's a waste of your time and don't bother with it.
Yeah.
And that's really key, especially when you end up in a world, you know, the four albums that I made, the four albums I made this past year that are coming out this next year, literally all of them were made on an independent level, mm-hmm. with the artist either self-funding or me helping to cobble together funding for them. And a number of those will come out, were sold to labels and will come out that way. I think the important lesson there, again, and it comes down to something as silly as like who's buying lunch and where are you getting it, is that it changes a lot when the artist is responsible financially for the project.
Sure.
And one of the things I've been very proud about is being, and it comes from me and Joey coming up in a time in the music industry where money's lean.
Mm-hmm.
Like we started our career after music sales were sort of like wholesale run over by a combination of Napster and Apple.
Yeah.
So Joey and I had to figure out how to build a robust musical career on a completely shoestring budget. Mm-hmm. And there is literally no fat to be found. And so when you're making records for people who are paying for it themselves, you equally need to be able to pay the bass player what they deserve, and also you need to be able to save the artist money when you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not talking about like small amounts of money. Like when you get people to work for you, they need to be earning what they think they deserve.
Yeah.
But also, if you're working in a studio that charges $3,000 a day because it exists in a like a ecosystem where it can command that because of padded label budgets and whatever, it's nice to have a relationship with the studio owner to get that for $500 a day.
Yeah.
And that when you're then also spending the artist and your client's money, you can explain it to them in a way where we just got this $3,000 studio for $500 a day, which doesn't mean like we saved a bunch of money that can be spent elsewhere. It means that we're figuring out a way to not waste your money.
Yeah.
It means that we can pay the bass player what he needs to be paid so that he can contribute to your album in a reasonable way. So I don't know, there's a different style of making records that I think I'm also particularly suited to make because of me and Joey having to be scrappy and kind of coming up in a different system.
It sounds kind of like the Martin, where you thought the Martin should cost $2,100 and you work backwards.
Yeah.
If somebody had made 20 grand on Kickstarter, like,
totally,
it's your job to figure out how that pie gets cut up.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So it's all good things, and there's never not a challenge.
Yeah, of course. It's music.
Yeah, exactly.
Are you in Nashville pretty much all the time when you're not on the road now?
Yeah, Nashville and L.A. still.
Okay. I
go to L.A. a lot. Yeah.
And where do you fit in the Nashville world?
You know, I kind of keep my head buried in the sand over there.
You're like George Green with his cats.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
I love that community so much because it's actually accessible.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of thing that, you know, for better or worse, no joke, you know, like we've been traveling quite a bit touring since August, but you know, for better or worse, the last three times I went into my grocery store in the neighborhood, I ran into Dave Rawlins in the milk aisle.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, at this point, a pleasant conversation, which is good. But that's the sort of thing that doesn't happen elsewhere.
Yeah.
And you know, Dave and I have never collaborated musically, though I think it would be fun to hear that one day. but that kind of interaction and that kind of community
leads
to a much different thing than elsewhere. And it, that's the same exact grocery store where I ran into Pat Sansone from Wilco a week before our album and said, "Hey, do you want to play on our album?" Because up until that point, there was talks of somebody playing keyboards, but Joe wanted somebody flown in from LA, and Joey was sort of deferential to what Joe wanted. I wanted somebody closer to town. We couldn't think of the right person, and for some reason, Pat never occurred to me until he showed up behind me in the checkout line. And before even asking either of them, I thought, Joey's a fan of Wilco, and I think Joe can be sold on Pat, so I'm just going to ask him right now. And so that sort of thing happens, and it's a result of that community, and that's happening everywhere, you know, like the coffee shop I go to and the restaurants you go to and just what happens socially in a very natural way. You're in this melting pot of people that is actually quite relevant and quite interesting, and you don't have to, you know, in LA for that stuff to happen, you either need to ascribe to some really obnoxious scenes that come with their some social collateral, or you have to be willing to drive hours and hours around the Los Angeles basin to go pick and choose what you want to do. And I don't have the patience for any of that. But so I like Nashville. It also means it's when you just want to be alone. Sometimes it's hard. You have to kind of shutter the front door.
Don't go grocery shopping.
Don't go grocery shopping. But that's what Postmates is for.
How's your pedal steel playing?
Pretty good. I played some pedal steel on the Joe Pug record, in fact.
All right.
And nobody kicked me out of the room.
All right.
I'm trying to think if I played steel elsewhere. No, we had Rich Hinman out in our band during the fall, and there were a number of days where I got to sit down and play his steel after our sound check or mess around, and that's one of my favorite instruments.
Does he have a better steel than you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. What do you have?
Well, I have a 1972 Lloyd Green Showbud model.
Okay.
An SD10. That's great. It's actually a great guitar, and I love it. But it, like the vintage guitars, especially in the pedal steel world, it's like banged up and like some weird shit happens.
Yeah.
Whereas Rich has exactly what Russ Paul has. And I don't remember the name of the maker, but it's a guy that basically remakes the guitar that I have.
Oh, okay.
But on a modern level where, like, they're actually reliable and everything works smoothly. I mean, it's an amazing sounding guitar, Rich is. But also, I don't play guitar. I don't play pedal steel guitar in the way that anybody would want me to. And so that old guitar with its inconsistencies and its character lends itself to my sort of out-of-the-box approach to pedal steel playing anyway.
Are you like David Lynch? What are you doing?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay.
It sounds good. I think the next one, the next one you hear it on is on the Joe Pug record. But I don't think anybody's going to listen to that and go, they hired the wrong guy. I think they'll listen to it and go, that's a nice pedal steel guitar right there. Yeah. Thanks for asking, though.
All right, we good?
We good.
All right.